All right, 5 minutes after 9 o'clock. Thank you for tuning in to WOCA this Monday morning. One of my first jobs, actually several of my first jobs when I was a young guy were in factories up in New York. And I remember going to those factories, and in my mind I was doing something no different than what my grandfather had done. I remember stories of my grandfather having been in factories. My dad was a police officer, so he was actually, maybe when he was young, he had some factory work as well. I went back to New York, to that neighborhood, maybe 10 years ago now, and you know, that factory wasn't even there. Not only was it moved out, the building, the whole thing was gone. I have no idea if it moved overseas or not, but, you know, you don't have to be rocket science to know that we've had a lot of factories that have moved offshore, and it is one of those things that when you hear elected officials arguing about why that happened, they have different opinions as to why it happened. Why do factories move overseas or offshore or to Mexico or somewhere else? Harry Moser is on the phone. He would know more about this than I ever will. He has studied it. He might even know where that factory moved to that I used to work at. Harry is the founder of the Reshoring Initiative. He's the chairman emeritus of, I don't know how to say this, Charmilles Technologies Corporation with GF Machining Solutions. He's a leading industry spokesman for reshoring and sits on the board of the National Institute of Metalworking Skills. He's talking to us about the importance of accelerating reshoring. I couldn't agree more. And removing obstacles like the mine permitting process that are holding back U.S. economic growth. This sounds like a really great topic. I'm so glad we have somebody knowledgeable to talk to us about it. Harry Moser, good morning, sir.
Good morning. It's great to be here. Could I tell you my story that's sort of like your story?
Yeah.
Okay, so I grew up in Elizabeth, New Jersey, not too far away from where you're talking about, just across the river. And the biggest thing in town was Singer Sewing Machine. In its day, the building there was the largest building in the world. And my grandfather was a foreman. My dad ran about a third of the factory. I worked there summers in high school and college, and it was dominant. It was the company in its field in the world. And I went past 10 years ago, and the whole thing's gone. The whole thing, all of the production is done offshore. And I drove past then, and I cried for what my family had lost: the city, the state, the country, and what. And that was the motivation for starting the Reshoring Initiative, so to reverse that and bring some of those jobs back.
So the political element of this is that there are those who say that we have to tax corporations more, and the other side says, well, wait a minute, that's going to make them move offshore some more. What are your thoughts on the reasons for the outsourcing and all that?
You know, the reason for the offshoring. Primary reason was lower wage rates. You know, the consumer wanted to buy the product for the lowest possible price, and with wage rates very low, you know, 10 cents an hour, 30 cents an hour, you could make the product for less in China, India, Mexico, excuse me, than you could here. So the tendency was for the work to go offshore to meet the demand of the U.S. consumer.
Are there any statistics out there anywhere that, and I'm guessing you have them probably at your disposal, that would indicate how much more we would pay if things were made here? I remember hearing this one time about cars, I think, that it's not that much more that we pay if American workers make products, then we pay. It's not that much difference. Is that accurate?
Let me dissect that a little bit. There's the manufacturing cost, which today is probably on the average 25% higher in the United States than it would be in China for many things, for a television set, a radio, a T-shirt, you know, a broad variety of things, probably 25% higher. And then there's the what the retail price would be. So if you make it here for 100, you make it there for 75. To get it here, duty, freight, packaging, carrying cost of inventory, intellectual property risk, opportunity costs, all kinds of things, takes that 75 up to maybe 90 or 95 when you count all those factors in. So even though they could make it, even though their wages are 20% as much and they can make the product for 80% of our manufacturing costs, the selling price would probably only be 5 to 10% difference.
Oh, wow. That is and that didn't even occur to me about that. And what about the taxes that we pay for imports? Does that add to it as well?
Well, the duty is part of that closing of the gap. That's in there. And unfortunately, the TPP, the Pacific Trade Agreement, will tend to reduce those duties and make the U.S. even more susceptible to offshoring.
So are corporate taxes something we need to be concerned about? Are they good or bad as far as reshoring is or offshoring is concerned?
Well, corporate taxes in the sense of corporate income tax is clearly companies try to minimize all their costs, and if we impose a significant corporate tax rate, they will tend to go where the tax rate is lower. And our corporate tax rate's about 35%, and most countries are now about 20, 22%. And so, and it isn't that you really have to get the companies to pay less. We have a nominal rate of 35%, but the average effective rate is more like 22%, and the difference is all kinds of special deals. And so many people would say get rid of the special deals, take the nominal rate down to 22%, and then companies will look at it and say, yeah, that's not so bad.
There are certain things that I'm guessing you can't get offshore, but you can outsource in a way by having illegal immigrants, and I'm not trying to bring that topic into this, but I'm just guessing like the mining industry, the farming industry, you can't outsource them. I guess you could outsource farming, but you can't really outsource mining. But
well,
really,
actually, one of the topics we will eventually talk about we cooperate with the National Mining Association, and we'd like to see more mining done in the United States. And one reason we're not having more mining here is that it takes 7 to 10 years to get the permitting process completed to be able to start the mine, whereas you can do it in 2 to 3 years in Canada or Australia. So yes, mining has been offshored, partially because of too much bureaucracy in the U.S. government, and minimizing that bureaucracy will help to bring the mining back.
There was a story this morning, I think the country was Mongolia, where the story was actually about Burger King announcing that they were opening up a restaurant in Mongolia, but the bigger story is the reason why fast food restaurants, Burger King being one of them, is because Mongolia is, I think it was Mongolia, I might have the wrong country, but we're starting to mine for copper and gold, and they were starting to make a lot of money in that country because they were doing it.
Yeah, overall, in the developing countries, wages have been going up rapidly for reasons such as you described. So in China, for example, which is where most of the offshoring has gone, wages have been going up at 15 to 20% per year for the last 15 years. So they've gone from almost nothing to something, to maybe a fourth or a fifth of the U.S. level, and that has closed that manufacturing cost gap to the point where when you look at all these other costs that the companies historically ignored, when they look at what we call total cost of ownership, it now makes sense to bring some of the work back.
Where are you right now?
Kildare, a suburb of Chicago, northwest suburb.
Okay, so Chicago would be a heavy union area. We are not a heavy union area right here. And so hosting a radio show in an area where there's a lot of people who are feel very unfavorably about unions, I wanted to talk about that just for a second. My experience as a factory worker when I was a kid was that, A, I was entry-level right out of high school. I was working in factories. I made a pretty good wage. I had whatever dental and medical that they offered. I probably never used any of it, but I had it. And I got double time, I think it was, for overtime. It was really a good job. And it was because of the union. Now, a lot of people who are anti-union, and I get these calls all the time, they're probably trying to call in right now, but they will say that the unions were the cause for a lot of these companies moving offshore. Is there any truth to that at all?
Yes, yeah, there is some. The unions certainly did a good job 100 years ago or so and to get safe conditions, fair compensation, et cetera, but they also tended, in some cases, to go too far. The hourly cost to have a worker in the auto industry at one time was $79 an hour for not especially highly skilled people. And it doesn't make sense. You can't survive at that. They tended to have work rules that made the factory inefficient. So a combination of the union going to extreme and making it too costly to operate here, and the companies sometimes being short-sighted and seeking out the lowest wage rate that they could find and trying to get away from those unions. You know, if the two had been able to compromise and come to something that was fair to both, I think we'd have a lot more manufacturing jobs here today. So I wouldn't put it all on the unions, but they have to take some of the responsibility.
You know, that is probably the most level-headed answer I've ever had to that question. Harry Moser is our guest. We're talking about the importance of accelerating reshoring and removing obstacles like the mine permitting process, holding back U.S. economic growth. Let's take a little break. If you're trying to call in, by the way, I won't be able to get your call. We're having a phone line problem, so Harry is on the line that the listeners normally use, which means I can't take calls from listeners this morning until we get that fixed. We might get it fixed for a few other interviews this morning, but right now during this interview I won't be able to take your calls. However, you can text us if you want on Facebook, et cetera. We'll figure something out. But we'll take a little break and be right back. This is WOCA.
The weather is what?
All right, 90 minutes after 9 o'clock. Thank you for tuning in. I think the first part of our discussion with Harry Moser has been kind of a thumbnail sketch, so I want to make sure we focus in on the primary thing that Mr. Moser wants to talk about regarding reshoring. There's a story this morning, real quickly, Harry, regarding the oil and gas rigs in the state of North Dakota. It says the number of rigs actively exploring for or producing oil and gas in North Dakota held steady for the third straight week. The North Dakota Industrial Commission reports 68 rigs in service as of today, unchanged for the last 3 weeks. They are really, I mean, their economy has boomed because of what they're doing in North Dakota.
Correct. Shale gas fracking has been huge for North Dakota. It's been incredible for the country, and it's more than just the dig, you know, the fracking, the digging of the wells, et cetera. There's the making of all the equipment that goes into the wells. Most of that equipment's made in the U.S. And then because we have about the lowest natural gas prices in the world, we have had and are projected to have about $150 billion, that's with a B, dollars extra investment in refineries to process that natural gas into plastics, into fertilizer, into the things that we use in life, so to speak. And so collectively that's hundreds of thousands of jobs.
Wow. And yeah, and some of the peripheral jobs as well. I mean, just feeding the workers is making money. Just the food truck, for example.
In manufacturing, for every job in manufacturing, you get on average something like 1.42 additional jobs supporting them. The food trucks, the doctors, the lawyers that sue the companies, you know, the whole thing gets – there's jobs, a lot of jobs out there.
So I guess two questions in one. I hit the microphone. That's what the noise was. Two questions in one. Could a president make a big difference in the obstacles that are in the way right now? And are there reasonable concerns by the environmentalists?
Okay, are we talking specifically about mining? manufacturing in general?
That's a good question to my question. I guess mining. Yeah.
Okay. Let's start with mining and then go on. Could the president make a big difference? I say yes. There are two bills, one in the House by Congressman Amade that has passed, and one in the Senate by Senator Murkowski, which is still being debated. And when those pass and then they come to a joint bill, the president can sign it. And that signing that and implementing that will help to reduce the permitting process from the current 7 to 10 years down to much fewer years, so that companies will be much more willing to go ahead and develop mines in the U.S. instead of offshore. So that's something a president could do. Environmentally, the mining industry, I'm sure, had issues 100 years ago, like all industries had 100 years ago. But now they're very responsible. They've got the government looking at them. They've got somebody ready to sue them if they do something wrong. They have more feeling of personal responsibility than I think people did 100 years ago. So I don't think environment's an issue.
Okay. So in that way, I mean, going back to the just for a moment here, the influence of the unions, that is one good influence of a union. You would have miners who are having every safety precaution necessary in place.
Yeah, and I say initially that was due to the miners, but now the government and our general legal institutions have taken over some of that responsibility, so that the union isn't as necessary. So for example, in the auto industry in the South, which is non-union, and if you compare that to the auto industry in the North, which is union, I suspect that the safety rates are just as good in the South, if not better, even without the union.
One thing that I was surprised to learn, and I'm guessing I learned this from another guest, is that the very things that make our technology, the elements in our computers, are all mined. Everything comes out of the ground. And I don't know if they come out of the ground here or overseas, but we always think of mining as coal or oil. We don't think of it in terms of the elements, and I don't even know what to call them, but the pieces that make up the components in our computers.
No question. There's hundreds, I think, of minerals, but the National Mining Association, the group that has put us together, is responsible for minerals like copper and gold and iron and molybdenum, zinc, silver, nickel. The materials that go into a broad range of, like you say, semiconductors, cell phones, jet planes, things we use all around us.
And so while a company like Apple can boast that they're made completely in the United States, it's not completely true, because some of those elements come from mining that took place overseas.
I parse that a little bit further. Apple claims that they are 100% designed in the U.S., but manufactured offshore. So almost all the Apple products are manufactured offshore, typically in China by a company that we call Foxconn. Apple does have a factory in the U.S. that's making some of the Mac Pros, and they have a couple of other products that they've made here, but I think 90-95% of what Apple sells in the U.S. is manufactured offshore.
Before we run out of time, What do we do as citizens? Do we write Congress? What do we do?
They could support the two bills that I mentioned. Write Congress in general is a good thing. For reshoring in general, if someone works for a manufacturing company and they know that much of the product that they're selling is now made offshore, then ask the management to rethink, to reevaluate that, and see if the wages have gone up high enough offshore, and if the costs and risks of moving the things here and the extra inventory and the inefficiencies in innovation of having engineering here and manufacturing there. If you put all that together, is it now time to bring some of that back? So I think that the people, the workers, can the employees can take an activist role within their companies, you know, respectfully asking management to make those reevaluations.
The initiative that we introduced you to when we first came on the air, is there a website for that so we can, for somebody who wants to dig deeper and educate themselves on all of this, is there information on that website?
Thanks for asking. So the Reshoring Initiative is reshorenow.org, and at that site they'll find the total cost of ownership estimator, which is a free software for doing that reevaluation that I described. And then for mining, it's mineralsmakelife.org.
Okay, and more so than we even realize, isn't that true? Mineralsmakelife.org and reshorenow.org, both good websites if you want to educate yourself on this topic and get the information you need to share it with other people. We also are recording this interview, of course, and this will be on our WOCA Facebook page and WOCA YouTube channel by 2 o'clock this afternoon, so you'll be able to share it with others. It's an important topic. I mean, that factory you worked in New Jersey, the Singer sewing machine factory, gone. What is it now, a field, a big empty field?
No, it's a building, and they've got, you know, boutique little things, companies of some kind, warehouses, all kinds of things. Some of it's gone, some of it's done boutique, but the thousands of workers, the buying of all kinds of material and machines from local companies, you know, that's largely gone.
I'm guessing Singer is in China?
It's probably all over the world.
The
company came to hard times. I think it got purchased a couple of times. I'm not an expert on what happened. All I know is that the main factory is gone.
Yeah. Harry, thank you for this interview and for keeping us up to date on what we need to know as voters, because these are the things we should be asking our politicians about, people running for office. Harry, thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Yeah.
All right.
Good.
We'll be right back.
The election season, the presidential candidates are out there, and they're all saying the same thing. We need economic growth in the United States. Well, October is National Manufacturing Month. Let's talk about economic growth here in the United States. Let's talk about bringing jobs back to our country. And we're going to talk to the man today who knows all about it, because he's right in the thick of it with the Reshoring Initiative, Harry Moser. Harry, it's a big, big topic out there right now with all the politicians, and they're saying, get more jobs back to America, get more jobs back to America. Is it possible that we're actually able to bring more jobs back to the United States out of the foreign countries?
Definitely possible. We've proven that because we're doing it. Comparing now to, say, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, we've gone from losing about 140,000 manufacturing jobs a year to last year we gained net about 10 or 20,000. So we've actually turned the ship around. It's just edging off in the right direction, but it's going in the right direction.
But isn't the high value of the U.S. dollar right now compared to the depreciation of Chinese currency kind of a concern? Because right now the Chinese are going to say, wait a minute, we could still manufacture here and do it a heck of a lot cheaper.
Yeah. The Chinese have lost a lot of their competitiveness because their wages have been going up at 15 to 20% per year for the last 15 years. And so that wage rate increase is much more important than the 3% currency devaluation that occurred a few months ago. Certainly, I think they should raise their currency by 50%. And so going 3% negative is certainly, from our viewpoint, the wrong direction, but it's small relative to how much their wages have gone up.
Hey, Harry, when did we start seeing the big influx of U.S. manufacturing going overseas? Now, I go way back with a father that's retired General Motors, a union guy, and that's, you talk to my old man, he could tell you stories back in the day when they worked proud, worked hard, and now we see a lot of manufacturing, auto manufacturing and other manufacturing, overseas because it's so much cheaper for these companies. When did we really see this influx start to become a major problem here in the U.S.?
The offshoring itself started in the 50s with Japan. And at first it seemed like they were making toys, but pretty soon they were making very good products. So started then. The fastest rate of offshoring was roughly in the late 90s until 2008, somewhere like that. That 10-year period when especially China really got its act together and took a huge amount of work.
All right. Now, we mentioned the auto industry there. You know, I'm talking about my father, former GM employee. We see still a lot of American cars that are manufactured overseas, but don't you think it's ironic, Kerry, that a major Honda plant is here in the United States, a major Toyota plant is here in the United States? Why are we seeing foreign companies building cars here in America and American car makers still operating overseas?
The basic logic that most of the companies follow is that it makes sense to make a product in the market where it's going to be sold. So the reason Toyota, Honda, Nissan, et cetera, BMW make cars here is because they want to sell cars here, and they've concluded that it's more profitable to make them here and sell them here than it is to make them somewhere else and ship them here. And the same holds true for other industries. When you make something somewhere else and you sell it here, you have to add 15%, 20%, something like that to your cost compared to what it would be if you made the product here. So you can afford to pay higher wage rates, you know, maybe have a little bit higher taxes, and still be more profitable making it here.
Now, you mentioned the cost there. I would think the number one high tick in that cost of manufacturing overseas is actually transportation, because the only way really you're going to get the shipment back here in the United States is through a container ship like Merck or a company like that, and they basically own the oceans. So I can't imagine the cost of shipping stuff from an overseas country into the United States, whether it be a car or whether it be a laptop.
Yes, certainly that's important, but it's of that 15 to 20% that I talked about, depending on the product, freight might be three or four of those points. But there's duty, there's carrying cost of inventory, the fact that you own it for a month or 2 months before you get it over here to sell to somebody. There's the effect of, especially for a U.S. company, you've got your engineers here and you've got your factory over there, and it's hard to get the engineers and the factory together to improve the product and the process of making the product because they're in different continents, different languages, different time zones, all this kind of thing. So there's a lot of opportunities you pick up when you bring everything back and do the engineering and the manufacturing in the country where you're going to sell the product.
And I can't imagine the insurance that these companies, the U.S. companies, must have to have something manufactured overseas and then put on a ship, because we hear of piracy. We have, of course, hurricanes and other natural disasters. And we just saw during the last couple of weeks, we saw a container ship go down in a hurricane. So the insurance alone has also got to be a couple upticks on the price of goods.
There's certainly some insurance associated with the freight, but also if you're having the product made in a developing country where you're not so sure about the quality, then there's also going to be some more insurance on the product liability.
We're talking with Harry Moser, who is the founder of the Reshoring Initiative. October is National Manufacturing Month, and we're talking about bringing manufacturing back to the United States, creating jobs, which, of course, improves our economy. Harry, kind of give everybody a background about what Reshoring Initiative is all about.
Okay. So I founded it about 6 years ago, and the mission is to bring manufacturing jobs back, and the method of doing that is to help companies look at all those costs, such as I described, and go away from just looking at the wage rate or just looking at the price from the factory overseas, but instead look at the insurance, like you said, the freight, the carrying cost of inventory, the opportunity cost when you can't deliver because your pipeline's too long. So we get them to look at all those things. We have a free online total cost of ownership estimator software at the website that the companies can use to do that calculation and reevaluate. And in some cases, we think maybe 25% of the cases decide to bring the work back.
Well, that website would be reshorenow.org, correct?
That's correct.
All right, www.reshorenow.org. I think the battle we are going to have, Harry, is with a lot of investors, and I don't know if you're familiar with the TV show Shark Tank, but people go in and they pitch a product or they pitch an idea, and then these multimillionaires say, we'll give you so much money for 20% of the company. But one thing that really irks me on that TV show is 9 times out of 10, they say, what's it cost to make that item, how much you getting for it, retail? And then, you know, if you made that in China, they always bring that, if you made that in China, you could make it for 5 cents. And I get so irritated at that. I'm saying, well, you're just taking jobs out of the United States. And some people have actually walked away from a deal on Shark Tank because they want to keep jobs in the United States. They don't want the manufacturing going overseas. You've got the mindset of those, quote unquote, sharks, and we have sharks in industry all over this country. How are we going to change their mindset? Because they're basically looking at the bottom line here.
You know, I've seen the show, and I think, is it Mark Cuban?
Yes.
I've seen him take the position of make it in the United States. So I think he's had a better perspective on that. I'd love to get the sharks and train them on total cost of ownership so they're less likely to make the China decision. So I think they're smart enough that they could be educated, and I'm. Any of them that are listening, give me a call. I'll come in and give you the course.
Yeah, and you just don't have to be on the Shark Tank. You could be listening right now. Own a business, even if it's a small mom and pop, and you're manufacturing overseas and you want to bring jobs back to America, get a hold of Harry because he'll be happy to talk to you. Go to his website and check that out, reshorenow.org. October is National Manufacturing Month. And, Harry, I've been doing my research, and one of the things that really surprised me is I've learned this by reading – $6.2 trillion worth of metals and minerals in the ground here in the United States that could bring manufacturing back. Right now, we're importing a whole lot of metals and minerals from foreign lands to use in manufacturing, aren't we?
Yes, we are. There's, I think, 43 minerals for which we import either all or we import on average about 50% of those minerals. So we're significantly dependent on those foreign sources. And the result of that is if I'm going to set up a factory and the products I'm going to make are dependent on those minerals, dependent on having a smooth, continuous, reasonably priced supply of those minerals, I'm reluctant to do that in the U.S. if I can imagine a West Coast dock dispute or a typhoon or a revolution in that other country or a war or something that would keep me from getting the minerals and all of a sudden my factory isn't operating. So having more of that mineral production in the U.S. makes me a lot more confident to make that investment to do the reshoring and bring back both the minerals and the manufacturing of the end product.
Now, when we say metals and minerals, and I don't want to go over the whole geological list of everything, but what are the top ones are we talking about here that we're bringing in from other countries?
It's easier for me to tell you what we are making. The National Mining Association, the group that put us together, their members make or mine copper, gold, iron ore, molybdenum, zinc, uranium, lead, you know, a variety of things. But there's still a broad range that we are not, and those are the ones that we have to do a better job of getting the permitting for.
Well, it's interesting you brought up the National Mining Association. The president, Hal Quinn, recently wrote an op-ed that was published in The Hill, and he's talking about the mineral situation and the metal situation here in the United States, and he says that basically it's not a lack of resources what we have here in the United States that's a problem. It's the third-rate permitting system, and I think that's – I'm quoting him there, third-rate permitting system. Why is it so hard for manufacturers to get the permits to go and mine the metals and minerals that we need to create jobs?
It's a question of having the permitting done – currently at the local level, the state level, the national level, different agencies all getting into it. It just takes, like I said, 7 to 10 years to get it done, whereas in Canada and Australia, for example, responsible countries, it's 2 to 3 years. So there's bills, one that has passed in the House, Congressman Amadei's bill, that would significantly improve that process, and Senator Murkowski's bill has not passed yet, but hopefully will soon. And when those pass and the two get together and get everything organized and it's signed by the president, should make a big difference in the permitting process.
Boy, I tell you, some environmentalists are hearing us talk right now about mining minerals and metals, and they must be boo-booed out over this and a little freaked out because, wait a minute, they're saying they're going to start stripping land and start digging big old holes to get minerals and metals in the United States. And we are an environmentally friendly nation. I think we've gone more green than any other country besides, I think, Eurasia, I'm thinking at this time. But how are we going to address the environmentalists that are going to obviously be protesting this and lobbying against this bill right here you're talking about?
Two things. First, the industry, which undoubtedly was not perfect in the past, is very responsible today. And if you check the records, you'll see there are very few incidents, very few problems. And second, if you assume that the products are going to be made, that the cars, the television sets, the semiconductors, whatever you are going to be made somewhere in the world, that means the mining is going to happen somewhere in the world. And if it's happening in a third world country, we all know that there's going to be a lot more environmental damage and risk than if it's done here in the U.S., where it's carefully watched and there's lawyers out there to go after them if they don't do it right. So the environmentalists should be applauding this because they're bringing the work to the place where it will be done most responsibly.
And I think you've made a very valid point there. In these third world countries where we are mining, we don't even know if it's children going and doing the mining. We have no regulation overseas when it comes to labor laws. We have no regulation as the United States into environmental impact. And if you brought that mining, in my opinion, back to the United States, it would, as you said, fall under more regulation and more scrutiny, I would think.
Yeah, we need tough regulation on doing the mining, but quicker permitting to get started.
And anybody that wants to read some of the stuff we're talking about, educate yourself. Go to this website, mineralsmakelife.org. There's some really interesting reading, including the op-ed I was talking about and also the bill that's currently going on that we were just discussing. You can read all about that. And there's also some really cool news on that website, mineralsmakelife.org. They just recently revealed some huge mineral wealth in Michigan, didn't they?
Yeah, there's so much out there. I'd like to own a piece of it, actually. One thing I'd like to come back to, you mentioned some of your listeners that might have their own small companies. On our website, we have a page called Resources for Retail Suppliers. So it helps them reevaluate which parts to bring back, helps them be more competitive with things like lean and automation, helps them find suppliers of components, get financing. We've got a couple of banks on there, and so they can find what should be most of the resources they need to make the decision and implement the return.
You brought up your website, and I'm going to shoot back to that right now, kind of like jumping around here. It's reshorenow.org, reshorenow.org. Back to some of the reasons why we need to reshore, since this is National Manufacturing Month, and we're talking about getting jobs and manufacturing back in the United States. What about local tax incentives? I mean, what can our local governments do and our state governments do outside of Washington to try to encourage this reshoring?
Yeah, it turns out that maybe a third of the cases of reshoring involve government incentives. So lower taxes, free land, roads, training, something like that. And that's certainly a good thing for them to do. I think the single best thing that the cities and the states can do is skilled workforce. We don't have an adequate supply of toolmakers, precision machinists, welders, people like that. especially in comparison to, say, Germany or Switzerland that have these great apprenticeship programs. And so our country should be encouraging more students to go into those fields through apprenticeships, through community college in high school. I was at a conference last week, and one of the community colleges works with the local high school, and when the kids graduate from high school, they have an associate's degree in something like manufacturing technology, and they're ready to go out and work. So if we had more of our localities do that, and we had a better, stronger, better-trained, skilled workforce, it would go a long way to solving the problem.
Well, let me ask you, since you know more about this than I do, one of the things, if you look back into our nation's manufacturing history, I mean, what we're going to talk about going way back to World War II, World War I, where our nation's factories were changed into national defense, basically, factories, where metal was being used to create tanks and not cars, and different industries were teaming up to help fight the Great War. What is this sending jobs overseas done to national defense? I mean, are our factories here in the United States, God forbid, are they ready to step up and do that once again if needed?
I'd say no. I talked to a senior military person. I said, what happens if we have a war? What are you going to do when you run through the inventory of bullets and tanks and so on? How are you going to make more when we don't have the capabilities? He said, we assume the war is going to be quick. So our steel production is down dramatically. The factories that would make the parts are significantly, not totally by any means, but significantly reduced. And even more important, we've lost the vast majority of the companies that make the machine tools and the foundry equipment and the other things that we need to rebuild the factories to make more of the things that we need. So World War II would be a lot tougher today.
Oh, absolutely. And, of course, it's a whole different, quote-unquote, war that we would be going into, and that's probably why that official said that it would be over soon, because it's all going to be done by computers in the sky. But still, we need those factories here ready to go, because what if the country you go to war with is the one you're getting all your supplies from? You think they're going
exactly.
to cooperate? You know, are they going to cooperate?
Yeah.
Yeah, no way.
I don't think so. No, very good point. Excellent.
They're not. Yeah, you're dropping bombs on me. You think I'm going to give you the material to do it? You're crazy. Harry Moser with the Reshoring Initiative is on the line with us this morning talking about October National Manufacturing Month, getting jobs and manufacturing back in the United States. And the website, again, is reshorenow.org. I want to talk about some of the programs that we have available from reshorenow.org, excuse me. The economic development program that you're currently working on that's, minimal cost, right?
It's actually free. Anybody can pick up our program, you know, the wording of the program, the concept of the program. We're retained by Mississippi and Pennsylvania to help them reshore. And what they do is they bring us out and we train their economic development people, their manufacturing extension partnership, which is part of NIST, affiliated with NIST in the government. And those individuals then go out to the companies and educate the companies on total costs, so the companies then make the decision to bring some of the work back.
And when you bring some of that work back, again, we're creating jobs, we're growing the economy, but aren't you also creating higher quantity and quality of manufacturing and a higher quality and quantity of a skilled workforce? I know we've touched on that in the past, but isn't that what it's all about?
Sure. You can't bring it back. You're not going to bring back the absolute most manual work. You're going to bring, on the average, we bring back the higher tech, more advanced manufacturing work that takes the skills. And so reshoring needs more recruitment of those skills, but the skills only get recruited if the worker, if the guidance counselor believes that manufacturing is coming back, because how can you tell Susie to become a welder if there aren't going to be any welder jobs?
See, that's, I think, education system, and I've been out of the education system now for over 30 years, showing my age. But I remember going to high school, Harry, and we were made to take, quote-unquote, shop class. What it turned out to be was woodworking. I learned how to weld in metal class. We had plastics class that we were required to take. Each semester you took a different kind of of shop class. But in retrospect, I see they were seeing, all right, who's good at this and who's good at that, and maybe how we can push them in the right direction for their future. Are schools even doing this stuff anymore?
I'd say shop class per se isn't as prevalent, especially maybe in middle school. But in the high school, and in the high schools, most of the machining programs and things like that went away, but they're starting to come back. I'm on the board of NIMS, National Institute for Metalworking Skills, a credentialing organization, and the number of credentials they're giving out, that they're awarding in the high schools and community colleges, is growing. Had been growing at 15% per year. Last year it grew at something like 40%. The MSSC provides similar kinds of skills, a little more basic. So there's some very positive signs that people are starting to learn that these are great jobs to go for.
Harry, you know, we're talking about schools here, and every parent that I hear talking about their child, oh, my kid's going to be the next doctor, my kid's going to be that, and everybody is, you know, we got to go to a four-year school. You know what? I've been in radio since I was 16. I went to a two-year school. It's an AS degree. That's all I got because I talk for a living. But it seemed like back in the day, a lot more kids were going to trade schools or to, quote-unquote, technical schools. How are we going to change the mindset of parents to say, and I hate to sound rude, and I know this is going to come off the wrong way, you know, your kid's not that bright, and he's not going to be the next doctor, he's not going to be the next lawyer. Maybe you ought to look at a tech school or a trade school and get him in there so at least they'll be able to have a job and they can support themselves, because a lot of these tech and trade schools helped in developing the skill force for manufacturing jobs. How are we going to change that mindset?
First, I'd parse that a little bit and say that for the manufacturing that we have today, we need some of those kids who could have been the doctor or lawyer. They have to have advanced computer capabilities, trigonometry, maybe calculus. They have to understand some physics. So these are kids that could have become engineers, could have become, you know, most anything with a four-year degree. We need some of those to go into these, what I call professions. So that's the second point. We would not call them trades or vocations. We would talk about the tool and die profession or the plumbing profession, because, and then I'd train them really well like the Germans and the Swiss do, and I'd make sure that they understood that they make an income that's comparable to what the university graduate makes. And as long as they're good at what they do, that's a reasonable expectation.
And the more we bring manufacturing back into the United States, the better the salaries, I would think, for somebody that's well-equipped and qualified, you know, to go out and do that job, from moving from a plumber to something else.
Yeah. Well, on the average, the incomes in manufacturing are about 19% higher than in non-manufacturing. And so and that's true at the, I think, the university level and at the, say, high school graduate, but with a certificate or some kind of specialized training level. So it's an excellent opportunity. And if you look at the fact that if, say, you go into an apprenticeship, there's no college debt, there's no hundreds of thousands of dollars to get the degree, and you start working immediately. So when we do the calculation, we say that a tool and die apprenticeship, someone who's gone through that at the age of 49 should have $1 million more net worth than the average English major.
Wow. You know, when you put it that way, I'm I don't see why we're not doing more and more of this, of getting the kids into the right alley to go to and say this is what you really need to do for your future. And you're absolutely right that a lot of these kids are, you know, they went and got the four-year degree, but you need the engineers, you need the calculus, you need all that stuff. I didn't mean to belittle education or anything like that. I didn't want to come across.
Although, here's an interesting story. There's a community college in Milwaukee Area Technical College, and they brag about the fact that they're the second largest graduate institution in the state of Wisconsin, because only the University at Madison has more students who already have a bachelor's degree. So you've got lots of people with bachelor's degrees coming back to get an associate's degree in technology so they can get a job.
Wow. Harry, I know we've only got about a minute left. Harry Moser with the Reshoring Initiative online with us. We're talking about National Manufacturing Month, bringing manufacturing jobs, what we need to do, get them right back here in the U.S. With 1 minute left, Harry, is there something that we didn't touch on that you think it's important for the audience to hear?
Now, one, obviously, support the mineral effort. You know, contract your representatives. And second, we're a not-for-profit. Our mission is to help. So any of them that have a company that they'd like to have educated, have to learn about total cost, they can go to our website, reshorenow.org, and they can email me, and I'm here to help them, and they can make a difference.
All right. Mineralsmakelife.org is one website we have talked about if you want to check that out, or if you want to talk out Harry Moser and the Reshoring Initiative website, that is reshorenow.org. Okay, Harry, I just stopped the tape, brother. We were right at the 30-minute mark there. I'm sorry I took you so long.
No, Jeff, it was a great interview. I enjoyed our conversation. Most winters I come down to Siesta Key.
Oh, beautiful. That's about 45 minutes for me. I'm in St. Pete.
Yeah, wonderful area. Yeah,
I love Siesta. A friend of mine used to have a condo right on the point there. It was just you walked out the back door, and then you were right on the beach, and you were able to walk down to the square, to all the restaurants and the bars and stuff. Yeah, I don't get down there enough. Siesta Key is beautiful. All right, Harry, I'll let you go because I know they got you lined up for other stuff today, but I do appreciate your time. Very informative today. Very informative. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Bye-bye.
All right, have a great day, sir.
Yep. 20 minutes after the top of the hour, I'm Bill Martinez. You know, this election season, presidential candidates are highlighting the need for economic growth in the United States. Now, October is National Manufacturing Month, an opportunity to highlight the growing trend in the U.S. for American companies to reshore manufacturing production and focus on bringing manufacturing jobs and services back to us and back to the U.S. How about that? Reshoring, the practice of bringing manufacturing and services back to the U.S. from offshore, is a fast and efficient way to strengthen the U.S. economy because it helps balance the trade and budget deficits, reduces unemployment by creating good, well-paying manufacturing jobs, reduces income inequality, and fosters a skilled workforce. That and many other benefits. And here to explain it to us is the founder of Reshoring Initiative, Harry Moser. Harry, welcome to Bill Martinez Live. How are you?
Hey, Bill, it's an honor to be here. You made the case so well, you don't need me this morning.
No, I do need you. I'm sitting here because my first question, because I think it's absolutely key for people to understand. I mean, we have this, we've been talking about this, trillions of unpatriated money that's just sitting there offshore. And, you know, the government isn't moving, and their idea of bringing it back is a disincentive as opposed to an incentive to get these companies to say, hey, look, bring that money back here. Give them whatever it takes in order to do that. They want to participate. I believe they do. They want to bring that money back. This is an American company and American ingenuity. But the government, I think it's quite ironic, Harry, and you know the history better than I do, but, you know, the government, you know, encouraged business to go offshore, do all this business, and they didn't have any way to think that, they just thought, okay, we're just going to help businesses expand. But, you know, they were rather naive on how business works. And now here it is, they've got all this unpatriated, patriotic money that's sitting offshore.
You know, actually the U.S. is about almost the only country that tries to tax companies' offshore income that's generated offshore. Almost all the other countries, Germany, France, et cetera, only tax the income that's generated in their country. So their companies can move money anywhere. We've created the problem for ourselves.
Well, the government wants to be like a quasi, stockholder, right?
Yeah, basically. You could say that.
Go ahead.
That's a consideration, but equally important, we'd say two other considerations. The if we can get the companies to look at all the relevant costs and risks of offshoring, things like the West Coast dock strike, the Chinese wages going up at 15% a year, the intellectual property risk, et cetera. If we can get them to look at all those things, those that will help substantially to bring the work back. And then secondly,
Go ahead, Harry. I'm sorry.
Okay. So second consideration, just to get in there, is that the U.S. is very deficient in mineral production. So it takes about 7 to 10 years to get the permits to open a mine here, and you can get it done in 2 to 3 years in Canada or Australia. So the companies tend to go off and do their mining elsewhere. And since we don't have the dependable mineral supply locally, our U.S. companies are less likely to build their factory here because they don't have that supply of materials they need to make the products.
Yeah, there are things that are to their advantage. But there's a reason they went overseas and went offshore. And part of what you're alluding to here, Harry, is the government regulations that have made operating in this country rather tedious. Even New York has kind of woke up to the fact that, hey, forgive us, we're gonna work with you. We're gonna be more business centric. Texas has been doing this for a long time. In fact, when Rick Perry was governor of Texas, he said he would spend an hour or two every day just talking to California businesses. And California is totally delusional. I happen to be on the West Coast these days, and it just to me it's unconscionable to hear the government, the governor talk about how they've increased jobs and done all this. Wait a minute, you're not even at net neutral here after all the jobs and companies that you chased out of this state, and now you've settled for low level jobs. You've chased away a lot of good companies that were founded here, and it is rather amazing. But I think this is all part of the formula in terms of the reshoring initiative, and reshoring is important to America, isn't it?
If my objective is to balance the trade deficit, to reduce imports to the level of our exports, that's about $500 billion a year. It's about 3 to 4 million manufacturing jobs. When we do that, we'll significantly strengthen the middle class, push incomes up for most everybody, especially in the middle class. We'll cut the budget deficits, the federal budget deficit, in half. So just major impacts for the country.
You talked about reforming and looking at our country's current mineral policies. When you bring that up, you've got environmentalists, you got everybody that steps in, and wait a minute, we don't want anybody digging into our country, and this is going to disturb the natural aspect of things here in this country we fought for so long and that sort of thing. So how do we find that balance to where we can, do what we need to do with minerals here in this country and, keep environmentalists happy?
I think if the environmentalists take a broader perspective, they'd say, first, the U.S. mining today is very environmentally conscious. There's so many regulations, lawyers, people looking over them that the companies are very responsible. And second, that the U.S. mining is dramatically more environmentally conscious than the third world countries where the minerals will be dug if they aren't dug here. So
exactly.
Actually, the environmentalists should be asking to bring the mining here responsibly, checked on, audited, because the world will be safer if we do that.
And that's what we do here in America, don't we? I mean, I don't hear so much that we're, trying to go around these things. I think we've appreciated, what the environmentalists have brought to the, to the discussion, the laws that have been enacted. I think that there's been some positive things here. But you just can't continue to allow one particular interest to override what could be the benefit. So it's trying to find that balance, right?
Yeah, sort of like Spock said, the needs of the one versus the needs of the many.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Now, where can people go for more information, Harry?
It's reshorenow.org, and for the mineral subject, it's mineralsmakelife.org.
Well, Harry Moser has been with us. He's the founder of the Reshoring Initiative with more than 45 years of manufacturing experience, most recently as chairman emeritus of Charmeal's Technologies Corporation, now GF Machining Solutions. Harry Moser, I'm Bill Martinez. Thank you, Harry. It's 28 minutes after the top of the hour. We've got more. Stay with us, America.